Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the battle for Mosul in Iraq is underway. It's the largest city currently controlled by ISIS, and the Iraqi government, with the help of the U.S. and Kurdish fighters, are now trying to retake the city. Joining us from Erbil in Iraq is Mike Giglio, correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He's with us on Skype. And Mike, you were near the front lines in this offensive just today. Where were you and what did you see?
So I was with the Kurdish forces called the Peshmerga last night and a lot of today. And they were the ones that actually initiated the first stages of the Mosul offensive from a front line in an area called Qazir. So I was with them last night as they prepared for the offensive. And then from the earliest hours this morning, I think we got moving around 5 a.m., they rolled across what had been their front line with ISIS until last night, and then pushed pretty deep inside ISIS territory, moving to take some villages from ISIS over the course of the day.
Were they successful?
They were. You know, we were part of a really long convoy with the Peshmerga pouring in troops and vehicles and weapons. And, you know, they were menaced by mortar fire. There were gun battles between ISIS and Peshmerga troops. But to me, it seemed pretty clear that ISIS was really on the retreat. And the Peshmerga did move pretty efficiently to take the villages that they targeted.
And what about the people who are in these villages who aren't necessarily ISIS, but they live there? Are they joining forces with the Peshmerga when they come in, or how do the ordinary people react?
See, that's actually one reason that I think this was able to move so quickly. These villages have mostly been abandoned. A lot of them were Christian villages before ISIS, and the residents have been just completely displaced. So these really just were scenes of battle. In the future, and I think on some of the Iraqi military's fronts, this is going to probably be the key question for the offensive. When you do have concentrations of civilians, especially when you push into Mosul City, which has, according to the Iraqi government, at least 1 million civilians still inside, how do you manage that? How do you spare them? I've had some conversations with Iraqi military officials over the last week, and they are extremely concerned about that. And I don't think they have a clear answer to how they're going to do that.
Well, what can you tell us at this point about the U.S. role in this effort to retake Mosul?
The U.S. role, I think, may be underappreciated. I think the best example of that is the fact that the Iraqi military is going to stage a lot of this offensive from territory controlled by the Peshmerga. These are two forces that are deeply suspicious of each other. They have a long, very bad history with one another. And as I understand, that arrangement was a result of months of very difficult diplomacy from the U.S. To get these forces to cooperate. But that cooperation is key. You have tens of thousands of soldiers now attacking ISIS in a pretty coordinated offensive. And again, U.S. military planners are pretty deeply involved in that coordination as well. And I think that cooperation, if the Mosul offensive is successful, is going to be, in retrospect, the key. This cooperation between the two best forces against ISIS, which are the Iraqi military and the Peshmerga. And the U.S. is just, you know, really to credit for that cooperation taking place.
Do we have a sense at this point of how long this battle is expected to go on?
I really don't think we do. And I think when I've asked U.S. officials and Iraqi officials about it, and they've been honest, the answer is that they're not quite sure because people aren't sure to what extent ISIS will fight back. In previous battles, ISIS has sort of vacillated between just leaving or putting up some resistance, especially early on, and then eventually falling back. The thing with Mosul is that it's such an important city to ISIS. I would argue that it's far and away their most important piece of territory. So I think it's not clear what kind of strategy they will employ. And we also do know that they've been building defenses in Mosul since they took it more than 2 years ago. So I think it just depends on what kind of fight they put up. And I don't think we can tell that yet from what happened today. It was pretty quick victories today, but they really haven't pushed into the main parts of the city yet at all.
General David Petraeus was on television yesterday saying that after this offensive takes place, if the Iraqi government is able to retake Mosul, the question will then be, how is it ruled after that? Is the system going to be able to be put in place to make sure that there's a functioning government in Mosul?
Yeah, I mean, that really is a crucial question. And again, we're speaking about this cooperation between the Iraqis and the Kurds. There, on the military front, there are intense political disagreements between both of those sides over what should happen in Mosul after ISIS. And I was actually meeting with a a senior Kurdish Peshmerga military officer yesterday who's working closely with the Iraqis. And his frame of mind was, this cooperation is happening now because ISIS is there and because the U.S. is in the room with us. But after ISIS, I don't see that continuing. And I think if that ends up being the case, it's going to be a real difficult situation in Mosul. And I think we're going to see some of the same problems return as far as governance and possibly sectarian issues that helped to pave the way for ISIS in the first place.
That's Mike Giglio, a correspondent for BuzzFeed News, joining us from Erbil, Iraq. He's been out with Kurdish fighters today as the battle to retake Mosul from ISIS continues. Mike, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, to campaign 2016 now, Donald Trump has been ratcheting up the rhetoric about the election being rigged. Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, his running mate, Mike Pence, was asked if the campaign would accept the election results.
We will absolutely accept the results of the election. Look, the American people will speak in an election that will culminate on November the 8th. But the American people are tired of the obvious bias in the national media. That's where the sense of a rigged election goes here.
But Trump's also been saying that polling places are rigged. Here's Trump surrogate Rudy Giuliani on ABC's This Week.
If you want me to tell me that I think the election of Philadelphia and Chicago is going to be fair, I would have to be a moron to say that. I mean, I would have to dislearn everything I learned in 40 years of being a prosecutor.
The Republican Party of Philadelphia would disagree with you. They looked into the
others are as well. Republicans who run the polls in battleground states like John Husted, Ohio's Secretary of State, also disagree. He said today the claims are irresponsible. And let's go to Philadelphia. David Thornburg is head of the Committee of 70, a nonpartisan watchdog group in Philly. He joins us on Skype. And David, your response to Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani's claims of polls being rigged.
Well, there's no basis in fact. I mean, they seem to be repeating this claim with increasing volume and increasing frequency as if that will make it true. But they're never citing any facts, so it's a little hard to refute non-facts.
Well, many Trump supporters are referring to the fact that in the 2012 Republican presidential election, Mitt Romney received no votes in 59 voting divisions in Philadelphia.
Well, my reaction to that is, have you been to Philadelphia recently, where there's an almost 8-to-1 Democratic registration edge? And it's absolutely not out of the question if you went to those neighborhoods that you would turn up no votes for Mitt Romney. The same was true. We looked into the city of Chicago. I think there were 37 precincts with no votes for Romney, and Cleveland we looked at, 17. That in and of itself certainly doesn't make a case for the wholesale fraud that the Trump campaign seems to be suggesting.
Well, even Joe DeFelice, who's chair of the local Republican Party there in Philly, says, I'm not going to sit up there and talk about divisions because they happen to be in areas more prone to vote for Barack Obama than Mitt Romney. Exactly what you said. It's entirely plausible. Look, are you saying that things have gotten better, that there may have been problems in the distant past, but they don't exist now?
The thing to know about election system is it's a human system. It's there are thousands of people involved in it at the ground level, serving essentially as volunteers. So mistakes happen. There's a lot of human error in the system, but it's a big jump between human error, you know, literally copying down some numbers wrong, and the kind of fraud that the Trump folks are suggesting.
Well, there have been isolated cases, a woman who voted on behalf of her mother, a woman who wrote in her own name on a ballot while another voter was in a polling booth. You know, people have been charged and have pled guilty. But what about the 1993 special election for a state Senate seat there in Philadelphia? Absentee ballots were thrown out.
Absentee ballots were thrown out and the court overturned the election. That was 23 years ago. And I think that sent a signal across the system that you can't get away with this sort of stuff anymore.
Well, Philly.com reported last week that in Philadelphia, 8 people have been arrested for voter fraud since 2013. Of course, thousands and thousands of ballots cast. And there's so much other research. The Brennan Center's report, The Truth About Voter Fraud, found most reported incidents of fraud were, as you said, traceable to other things such as clerical errors. And that incident rates were between 0.00004 and 0.0009%. And yet, David Thornburg, do you feel that trust in the democratic process in the U.S. is being eroded?
Well, that's what worries me about Trump's claims, is that by asserting this louder and louder, he is in fact eroding the trust and integrity that people have. Not to mention, I think that there's some undertone here that's trying to keep people from the polls, which is also very disturbing. Elections are very localized community endeavors. You know, we have 1,700 divisions here in Philadelphia. Each one of them has usually four or five older people staffing the polls. That's who we count on to uphold the integrity of the process.
Well, and by the way, people can participate. They can be watchdogs. Trump is asking his people to go to the polling places. But how does it work in Pennsylvania? Can you come from outside the county? How does it work?
No, the state election code requires that a poll watcher who gets a certificate from the party has to live in the county that he or she is going to watch. So we're really trying to guard against this sort of vigilante justice that I think is being suggested here.
That's David Thornburg, head of the Committee of 70, a nonpartisan watchdog group in Philadelphia. Do you mind if I ask your party affiliation?
I'm a registered independent.
Okay. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Drew Ackerman is a storyteller whose voice is so dull and stories so meandering that they're likely to put you to sleep, and that's the point. Drew's the writer, producer, and narrator of the hugely popular Sleep With Me podcasts, boasting of lulling, droning, boring bedtime stories to distract your racing mind. You be the judge. Here's part of the introduction to a recent installment.
Same thing with sweet tarts. I've had a sweet tart. I've been feverish from sweet tarts. Then there's bottle caps. Those don't make me feverish. I prefer the root beer bottle cap, by the way, if you're keeping score at home.
Yeah. He goes on about sweet tarts, about how tarts sound like torts, and there's legal torts, and that's just the introduction. He says his stories are what sheep use when they get tired of counting themselves. He has 1.3 million downloads a month, devoted listeners, and Drew joins us from Alameda, California, where, Drew, we're finding you're not at all like that guy in the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. It's who I am deep down, but I have to kind of stay calm. I tend to be a really animated, over-anxious person, and I think that might be one of the things about the podcast is I really have to slow down and stay calm and put my like self-critic aside. So I don't know if that's something that the listeners connect with or it really helps the show.
Well, it's incredible to hear you. I'm kind of relieved, actually, because the guy in the podcast is, well, who is he? I mean, and who are you? How did this start?
You know, it started like a long time ago. Like when I was a child, I had insomnia and I had a lot of worrying going on about school and overthinking. And I would just stay up the whole night worrying and being like, oh, now I can't fall asleep. And now I'm thinking about falling asleep. And it was like a terribly isolating thing because, you know, I come from a big family, but no one else really had trouble falling asleep. So they would kind of be like, oh, that's too bad. Or, oh, you know, drink some milk. But the one thing that brought me relief was listening to the radio. And I remember Sunday nights I would listen to this comedy show called the Dr. Demento Show.
Right, right.
And it would just distract me. And it made me feel less alone and less fixated on the rigmarole about not being able to fall asleep. And I just never forgot those memories.
Yeah. Well, now you've come up with Scooter, your alter ego, who's the narrator who voices those podcasts. Let's listen to another one. There's nuns and eggs and I think it's on a ship. Is this a spaceship?
Yes, it's a spaceship. It's my love of shows like Star Trek and books like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy come through, I guess.
Okay, let's listen.
And then the nun said, oh, okay. And then, of course, I said, okay, so there's not a battle situation because we're going to be landing. So that's the other thing. And then I said, well, how many eggs? And then it just happens that they said, you'll need everybody. You know, except for Stan and the ship's computer. Stan's going to be running autopilot.
What? Are you free form doing these? Or is this scripted?
So some shows I do are scripted and then some are free form. But I usually find that just having like bullet points and the more like structured it is between the points is the more room I have to kind of meander and follow my curiosity or over-explain, or over-indulge, or, you know, think about, well, geez, what kind of painting would be on that wall? Like, why would someone paint a wall green? And then my brain will be like, oh, what about color theory? And then I kind of just follow these breadcrumbs that my imagination kind of sets out.
Which is sort of how many brains work, or perhaps I'm revealing too much, when you fall asleep.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of it is like I want to create this aesthetic thing that's familiar, like that has narrative, just like we were told bedtime stories as children or, you know, stories that we hear in myth and stuff, but mm-hmm. that the listener doesn't feel the pressure to listen or learn anything. So I think it's like, okay, so you're going to be talking the whole time, but I don't need to pay attention. And I say, yeah, it's kind of like you're hearing me, but your brain's not making a connection or it's very loose.
Well, here's some of the reviews. Absolutely amazing. As someone who suffered from insomnia for years, I can tell you this works. And I have read how this works, but I still really don't know how it works. Do I care? Nope. Amazingly, it's something I do not need to overanalyze and keep me from sleeping. I'm just happy that it's here and it does work. Thank you, man behind the magic. Did you do any research into insomnia, or did you consult with specialists before launching this?
No. Like, I was just mostly curious myself. I've told bedtime stories to adults and children, and I said, well, geez, I love that podcasting has this freedom, you know, because you can develop a small audience in it.
Hold on. I just have to ask you, you've told bedtime stories to adults previously before the podcast?
Yeah, just like friends. Like if we're camping, I'd be like, okay, give me a couple words and I'll make up a story. And I found that those stories were always kind of meandering and people would, their attention would fall out of focus because they'd be like, okay, a turtle and a parachute. Those would be the words. And I just kind of like, why would a turtle have a pair? You know, is a turtle in a plane race? Is a rabbit in a turtle? Well, does a rabbit have a parachute? And then what color parachute would a rabbit have? So that's kind of going down a rabbit hole. I don't know. I think a part of it is that I've suffered from sleeplessness. And when I hear reviews like that, it really stirs something in me because I've been there. Could I help distract people, like to make them feel less alone? And could I make like these silly stories that are a little bit goofy? And then I just kept like refining it and editing the shows and listening to feedback. And like slowly an audience developed it. But I think it was an audience that was out there that said, like, I want a bedtime story too.
Well, Drew Ackerman, he writes, produces, and narrates the podcast Sleep With Me. He's got over 1 million followers. He lulls them to sleep. The only complaint that we've read is that sometimes people say you're so funny, they stay up because they want to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want like people to put people at ease, right? Because it seems like when at bedtime, everybody gets so serious and it's like, oh, and even like other cures for insomnia, it's like, oh, this should work for you. And then people are stuck in this position where it's like, oh, this isn't working for me. And oh, I got to be at work tomorrow, or I got a big meeting, or I'm traveling. I try to be silly without being too funny, because then it's like, okay, I definitely don't have to take this guy seriously. He doesn't take himself seriously. And maybe it deflates some of the anxiety out of the room at bedtime.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of another podcast from Sleep With Me by Drew Ackerman. This is something about like a retirement home battling Zeus or something.
I said, we're still on Earth, right? And they said, well, I guess. And I said, who lets a retirement home go to battle? Is Zeus Greek or Roman? I saw some peace tests, some tracks from two of the two dirt bike women. I said, I bet you those were furies or sirens.
Drew, thank you so much and best to you.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I hope this can help somebody out there fall asleep. Thanks a lot.
That's the voice of Jerry Emitachi. When we spoke at the Chickasaw Cultural Center in Sulphur, Oklahoma, a couple weeks ago, he was one of the last of the 30 or so remaining Chickasaw who was a native speaker, meaning he spoke only Chickasaw before he began grade school and learned English. His language meant everything to him.
You know, it's a part of our lives. It's in my heart, you know. Today, especially, you know, I've come to realize that's my identity. I am Chickasaw, and I am Chickasaw in my soul, in my heart, you know. That, I mean, it's deep within.
Well, we felt honored to meet Jerry Imitachi, and now we're so glad we recorded him. Jerry died this past Friday. His voice is stilled, but it lives on in a project to reclaim this endangered language through interactive portals at the center and mentoring programs in Chickasaw Nation. Joshua Hinson is the director of the Department of Chickasaw Language. He joins us from Oklahoma. And Joshua, first of all, it's just so unbelievable. We just sat with Jerry. I can't imagine how you're feeling. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Jerry was an amazing mentor and a teacher for all of us here in the program. And really, overall, the Chickasaw Nation, I mean, you can't go anywhere without somebody knowing Jerry Imitachi and him having touched their lives in some substantial way, not just in terms of his language ability, but his involvement in politics, his role as a pastor. We're really going to miss him here.
Yeah, well, and you personally seemed so eager. Let's listen to a little more. This is the two of you just falling into conversation in Chickasaw.
So, Chief Otoglok. Joanna Kano, so Chief Otog.
This is something that you had taken up as a very young person, that you wanted to learn this language and embrace someone like Jerry. What do all the elders, but what did he in particular mean to you?
Well, Jerry, like all of the other native speakers that we work with, they just represent this link, this critical link to our past, our present, our future. I mean, they hold the language in their hearts and in their minds, and it's something that we want so terribly badly. We spend as much time with them as possible because we want it to still be a spoken language in 100 years. We don't want it to, you know, to be on a page. We want to still be communicating.
Well Joshua Hinson, we learned at the center that the Chickasaw became Christians. Will there also be more, I don't know, Native American elements to your service?
Traditionally, we'll have a wake. So tonight we'll have a wake service for a couple of hours in Tishomingo. And then Tuesday, we'll also have the funeral service where the Chickasaw Language Committee and others of us on the staff will be singing some Choctaw hymns in Jerry's memory, followed by the graveside service.
As you think of your Chickasaw, what would you like to say to him?
Oh, I don't know if I can. Blenditak fuka chigma, shawich pisla chon, anoa, yamako, itanlitko, yakoke chimashlishki.
Can you tell us?
I just said I know I'd see him again.
Joshua Hinson, again, director of the Department of Chickasaw Language. For the Chickasaw Nation. Joshua, thank you, and again, so sorry for your loss.
Thanks, Robin.
There's an effort underway by airlines and passengers to get the rules changed when it comes to the emotional support animals that can be brought on board flights. Not just dogs, but also pigs, monkeys, and turkeys. A special advisory committee to the Department of Transportation met earlier this month to look into this issue. And joining us now is Vicky Croak, who covers all things animal for us. Hi, Vicky.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what is the purpose of this committee, first of all?
So this service animal working group was put together, in the words of the Department of Transportation, to address whether to amend the definition of service animals that may accompany passengers with disabilities on a flight. So the committee includes people from the DOT, airlines, and disability advocacy groups. And today we heard from the DOT that the committee decided to discontinue talks last week because they had reached the point where, quote, further talks seemed unlikely either to move towards consensus or generate significant new and useful information. So airlines are required to allow animals like guide dogs to accompany people with disabilities on a flight. And for more than a decade, the DOT has included emotional support animals. These come in a variety of species, and they provide support for animals with recognized mental or emotional disorders. But it's claimed that animals like pigs and turkeys are disrupting the atmosphere of jet cabins. And in the words of USA Today, the airlines would like to close the barn door on emotional support animals.
And I have to say, I fly a fair amount. I've never been on board with a pig or a turkey. I don't think. Maybe they were there. But you're saying no more pigs.
Well, we don't know if there will be changes and what they might be, but they could limit species. The Americans with Disabilities Act only recognizes two as service animals, dogs primarily, and to some extent, trained miniature horses.
So is the problem just a disagreement over the species that are allowed to travel in the cabin?
No, it might end up addressing other things, the size of an animal, or it might come down to the work animals do. What's a service animal versus an emotional support animal? The Department of Justice describes tasks that service animals do, but it says emotional support animals are supposed to provide comfort just by being with the persons. It can be really murky, even on their FAQ page, to the question of whether someone's dog calming them for an anxiety attack would count as a service dog. The answer is that depends.
Well, and I know that the complaint is that people are using the ability to bring these emotional support animals on when they really don't need them. What would be the point of doing that?
Service and emotional support animals can get benefits that pets don't. They fly without the usual pet fees. And unlike pets who are supposed to be kept in carriers under the seat, comfort animals on some airlines are allowed to even be on the passenger's lap.
Aren't there rules, though, already in place to prevent people cheating on this issue?
Well, I turned to Dr. Hal Herzog with that question. And he's an emeritus professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. And he has a special focus on humans and animals. And he points out that there's no federally recognized certification process for emotional support animals or service animals, and that current rules are, in his words, loosey-goosey. Here's what he had to say.
There are legitimate situations in which the company of an animal can enable to fly and live their life in a more full way. However, it's almost impossible for me to envision a set of rules which is going to be able to separate the real from the fake.
Online, people can purchase ways of getting away with that, by the way. There's no doubt in my mind that animals do tremendous things for us. The question is, well, how do we sort out what's fair for everyone?
That's Vicky Croak, who covers all things animal for us. Vicky, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Over the past year, three of the world's most recognizable brands, Volkswagen, Wells Fargo, and Samsung, have tarnished their own images with scandals. Brand experts say each company failed to adapt to a world where social media can spread bad news faster than a PR team can figure out how to respond. Marilyn Giwax, NPR senior business editor, has been interviewing brand experts, and she joins us now from Washington to share. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Robin.
And you know what? We've been thinking it is a trend, and it feels like it began with Volkswagen last fall.
Yeah, really. About a year ago at this time, Volkswagen, that's the people's car, the pride of Germany, turned out it was a big cheater. VW had an image problem. People used to think of them as really earnest and honorable, and then it turned out they were intentionally cheating on emissions tests. And that really flew in the face of what consumers had expected from VW.
Well, and so the beatdown began because, speaking of flying in the face of what consumers expect, Samsung's Note 7 was supposed to be a reliable alternative to the Apple iPhone, and that literally blew up.
Yeah. Wow. We could even do another one. That's a scorched earth policy for your brand. That scandal started back in August when they introduced this new smartphone, and consumers very quickly discovered that they were melting down. They had this faulty battery problem. So last week, the company pulled the plug on the whole line, and now they're trying to get refunds and customers coupons for their customers to get them back.
Well, and then, of course, we have Wells Fargo. And last week, the CEO, John Stumpf, retired.
Yeah, right. So actually, as a business plan, it turns out that ripping off customers and shareholders by creating massive numbers of fake accounts was maybe that's just not the way to go.
Right.
So last week, the company had to have its CEO is retired. They've been hit with a lot of fines. They have had huge reputational damage done.
Yeah. Well, so what do brand experts say? What went wrong? How can it be made right?
Well, I called a lot of brand experts because I was interested in it. These are, all three companies are from different parts of the world. Volkswagen's in Europe, the Wells Fargo's American, Samsung is South Korean. So how did everybody do the same thing wrong? And it turns out what they all agreed was that back in the old days, 10 years ago, even 6-7 years ago, corporations had time to put together a PR plan to try to spin bad news. But these days, consumers get so much of their information from Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all these other platforms that it's beyond the ability of a corporation to control its image when it's in trouble. You get caught up in a scandal and it's, before you can get your PR team into the conference room, people around the world have already tweeted out pictures of their melted down cell phones, and that's a real problem.
Right. Well, but in the seconds we have, they said, look at Toyota. I mean, if a company's beloved, it can come back.
Right. That's the big thing that these three companies have going for them is that they're old companies. They've been around a long time, and they're kind of actually beloved. I mean, consumers want to believe in them. So they can bounce back. But in the meantime, they're going to lose an awful lot of business. This will hurt their earnings and hurt their sales. And it's a big, long rebuilding effort for them.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax on what really is a trend. Marilyn, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we've reported here about how the spike in drug overdoses has a terrible, terrible silver lining. Since 2010, organ donations from fatal overdoses are up nationwide. We spoke with the New England Organ Bank. They see an increase of nearly 900%. But how's that playing out? Well, while some families say they find comfort in knowing that a loved one's heart beats on for someone else, organ donation can compound grief. Martha Biebinger from Here Now contributor WBUR reports.
For more than 24 hours, on the final day of June 2015, Colin LePage rode waves of hope and despair. They began when LePage found his 30-year-old son Chris at home in Haverhill, Massachusetts, unconscious after an apparent drug overdose. In a panic, LePage administered the opioid antidote Narcan and CPR, then raced with EMTs to the hospital.
When I first walked into the emergency room, I was getting the impression that my son was already gone. But while we were there in the hospital and they were working on him, is when they told me that they had a heartbeat and they were getting signs.
Signs that Chris's brain might still be alive. Chris, strapped to a gurney, was rushed by helicopter to Boston for more tests. Between efforts to stabilize his son's temperature and blood pressure, a doctor or nurse mentioned to LePage that his son had agreed to be an organ donor.
I want to say there's no urgency or something like, hey, you need to do this. I could see genuine concern and sadness that this had happened, that that was a life that he mattered to someone. It wasn't that, well, we're going to be able to use his organs for someone else.
The next morning, after another round of tests showed no signs of brain activity, LePage said goodbye to the son who'd been revived but was not fully alive.
I sat in a chair with him and in his hand, and it wasn't clinical. It did not feel like somebody's gaining something here. I knew that someone was, and that's comforting that someone else has been able to have a little piece of my son, and some of their pain is not what it used to be.
Chris's liver is at work now inside a man LePage only knows as David, a 62-year-old pastor. LePage reads the end of a letter sent via the New England Organ Bank.
A part of him now lives in me, and whenever I stand to speak, I say, thank you, Lord, for this family, who I am connected to in a way that is nothing short of a miracle. I pray someday we may meet. God bless you. Sincerely grateful, David. I just haven't had the time to write back to that powerful statement. But I will. I will do that soon.
LePage's experience is happening all too often, as patients addicted to heroin or other opioids take too much, stop breathing, and are declared brain dead. In 2010, 1 in 20 organs donated in New England were from an overdose patient.
This year so far, we are at 27%, which represents just over 1 in 4 donors that have died of a drug overdose.
Alexandra Glazier is president and CEO of the New England Organ Bank.
It's remarkable, and it's also tragic. We see this tragedy of the opioid epidemic as having an unexpected life-saving legacy.
At Lahey Hospital and Medical Center in Burlington, Massachusetts, the number of patients receiving a liver transplant has nearly doubled in the last 3 to 4 years. Patients at some hospitals balk at the perceived or real threat from the organs of drug users, but not at Lahey, where Dr. Mohammed Akud is in charge of transplants.
Most of these patients trust the fact that these donors are tested and they understand that their chance of dying while waiting for an organ is high.
Akud says Lahey has not had a case of HIV or hepatitis transmission in recent years. That's the case at Mass General in Boston as well, where Dr. Jay Fishman is associate director of the hospital's transplant center. He says an organ from someone who used drugs is not necessarily risky, and may be healthier than other options.
You have to remember that as awful as this outbreak is, these are younger people who are dying, often with needles in their arms, and many of them were first-time drug users. They weren't all addicts.
Despite this increase in available organs, there's no sign that supply is keeping up with demand for organs from aging Americans or those with a chronic disease. Dr. David Clausen is chief medical officer at the United Network for Organ Sharing, which tracks and manages organ donations in the U.S.
The number of people on the waiting list is increasing faster than the number of donors, even with the increases related to overdoses.
Family members who've lost someone to an overdose say organ donation is a nearly taboo subject among those affected by addiction. It triggers feelings of guilt, anger, and despair. Debbie Daigle sat next to her son Stephen's unresponsive body for 6 days before agreeing to turn off his respirator.
I laid on top of him all morning before they took him, and I had my head on his heart just so I could hear that beat. And they had to peel me off of him.
More than a year later, Daigle is still haunted by questions. Should she have asked for another opinion about the scans of her son's brain?
Never in a million years do you ever visualize kissing your child whose heart's beating and having to watch them wheel that stretcher away and know they're going to cut him open and take out a beating heart. I mean, you don't think about those things until it happens.
Daigle says she felt like her son died again when the transplant patient who received Stephen's heart did not make it. She's written to the patients who received his liver and kidneys, but has yet to hear from them. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
There have been rumors that Donald Trump might create a conservative TV network if he loses the presidential election next month. But today, those rumors reached a new level when we learned from the Financial Times that Donald Trump's son-in-law and campaign advisor, Jared Kushner, reached out to an investor about creating a Trump TV network. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jamie.
So the Financial Times is reporting that Jared Kushner reached out to someone named Arye Borkoff, who is the founder of the investment bank Lion Tree. What more do we know about this?
Exactly. The news that we know is that Kushner, who you said is Trump's son-in-law, married to Ivanka Trump, approached this boutique investment firm that specializes in media deals. And so for the last few months, people have been wondering, will Trump TV be the out for Donald Trump? And this seems to suggest that, yes, he is beginning to think about that now that he is down double digits in some national polls. Every political campaign is a media company. You have a show, the campaign, you have a star, the politician, and a distribution strategy with ads and surrogates and speeches. Every political campaign is a media company. But the Trump campaign has really, really, really been a media company. The CEO of his campaign, Steve Bannon, is the former executive chairman of Breitbart, right, an alt-right media company. The son-in-law, Kushner, is the owner of the newspaper, The New York Observer. Trump himself is a media celebrity. So this is a campaign that is exquisitely positioned to be a successful media company, even if it looks like it won't be an exquisitely successful political campaign.
And yet back in September, Donald Trump denied wanting to start a network. He told The Washington Post, quote, "I have no interest in a media company." Mm-hmm. But if he did create one, do we have a sense of what it would look like, how it would fit into the world of conservative media?
I think most people listening are probably thinking to themselves, all right, this is probably going to be a Fox News competitor, Trump TV versus Fox News, the new conservative movement versus the establishment conservative movement. But some people have pointed out that because Trump has been such a divisive figure, it could be difficult to get advertising for such a political news organization. And as a result, the second option would be to go over the top. That means to sell a video subscription service directly to conservatives who are among his flock, a little bit like Netflix for conservatives or like Glenn Beck's organization, The Blaze. This wouldn't necessarily require or rely on a bunch of advertisers that might not want to associate themselves with the tarnished Trump brand. He could go directly to his fans, directly to the tens of thousands of people who greet him on the stump and rallies across the country. And that could be a multi-million dollar opportunity.
So maybe not a cable channel, but something that maybe would compete with the cable channels that exist. What would it mean for Fox News?
Right. This is a really interesting question. You know, pay TV, cable television, is going through a period of structural decline. You have older Americans who are watching more TV than ever, but live viewing among teens and 20-somethings and even early 30-somethings is down not just a few percentage points, down something more like 30 or 40% over the last 5 years. This younger generation of viewers is moving away from pay TV. And so it is really interesting to think that not only could the conservative movement be fractured at the political level, as we see now with sort of Trump conservatives versus Paul Ryan conservatives and other senators who have essentially said they'll never, ever vote for Donald Trump, but you could also see the political media environment itself be fractured. You could have the Breitbart conservatives merging with Trump TV, and they could be against the sort of new, kinder version of Fox News that emerges after this election. It should be said right now that, you know, one of the people who is advising Donald Trump is Roger Ailes, who was let go from Fox News.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of questions about whether he's going to stay with Trump. I mean, maybe in a venture like Trump TV. Is there precedent for this, Derek, somebody losing an election and then trying to get into the spotlight in another way like this?
In one way, no, there is no precedent for what's happening in any element of this election, and there would be no precedent for something like Trump TV if it succeeds. But at the same time, you know, thinking about this question, one almost comparison is Al Gore, which sounds a bit nutty at first because Al Gore and Donald Trump are such opposites in every single way. But, you know, Al Gore became a media celebrity in a way. He, with the An Inconvenient Truth, his documentary about climate change, he won an Oscar. He ended up hooking up with Current TV, which he owned for a while, which won an Emmy. Al Gore very much became a media figure in the decade after his loss in 2000 to George W. Bush. So in a way, even people who lose national presidential campaigns still have the best 12 months of advertising imaginable. You are all over the news. Everybody in America has heard of you, and 40 to 60 million people will eventually vote for Donald Trump. That is an enormous amount of attention and buy-in to such a candidate.
And of course, this is all hypothetical. There's still an election. It hasn't happened yet. Derek Thompson,
that's right,
of The Atlantic, thank you so much as always.
Yeah, thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.